Our culture determines how successful we are in the workplace, the classroom, and life in general. And cultural conflicts define us, according to our guest this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday, July 3rd. We will talk about what's behind cultural clashes between Midwesterners and coastal residents, between men and women, whites and non-whites, and more. And we will welcome your questions and your experiences for our guest. Have you experienced any cultural clashes? Have you observed any cultural conflicts in your everyday life? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have with us Elena Connor. She is an experimental cultural psychologist, a science communicator, and co-author of Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. Her writing has also appeared in the New York Times Magazine and other outlets. She joins us by telephone. Hello, thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me, Joy.
Well, what motivated you and your co-author, Hazel Rose Marcus, to write this book?
So both of us are cultural psychologists, and we're very interested in why people with different cultural backgrounds fight. And we took hundreds of studies from across the social sciences to try to crack that nut and noticed a whole lot of patterns across these social sciences and wanted to put them in a way that people would not only appreciate but also enjoy.
And why is it important that we know this?
Well, our world is getting smaller and more crowded, and people with different cultural backgrounds are fighting more than ever before. And our book, Clash, explains why people are doing this and also what each of us can do to bridge the cultural divides while also gaining a better understanding of ourselves.
Yeah, you list several examples of cultural clashes that affect us noticeably. In fact, there's 8 of them, and we'll probably cover them all. But you say that they boil down to one fundamental difference, that some of us are interdependent and some of us are independent. Can you describe what that means and why that's important?
Sure. So, as you said, the root cause of, we find, most cultural conflicts is this clash of independence and interdependence. And let me explain what that means. All of us have two sides to ourselves. Our independent side wants to be separate, unique, and in control, while our interdependent side wants to be connected, similar, and cooperative. And depending on your particular mix of cultures, you tend to use one side more than the other. It's not deterministic. We all creatively combine our cultural backgrounds, our independence and interdependence, so we do have agency. It's not like we're totally driven just by our cultural backgrounds. Nevertheless, we do tend to, there's not an infinite number of ways we can be, and we find that many ways that people act sort into this interdependence versus independence. And then we also find that tensions flare when people using their more independent side interact with people using their more interdependent side.
How do I know what I am and what side I'm using?
It's funny, in our book we actually have in the final chapter a bit of a scorecard where people can look not deep inside themselves but actually to all the places they've been, all the cultures they've been a part of, to get a sense of, are they likely to be more independent or interdependent. Now, of course, biology matters, and of course there are more than 8 big cultural forces in our lives. We cover east versus west, rich countries versus poor countries, the coast of the U.S. versus heartland, plus also these daily tensions between genders, races, religions, social classes, and even workplaces. But there's also, there's age, there's generation, there's sexuality, there's also our pastimes and our hobbies are also cultures we're a part of. And so our system of figuring out whether you tend to be one or the other isn't complete. Nevertheless, it's a place to start to figure out, am I likely to tend towards independence versus interdependence?
Yeah, so let's just say hypothetically that we're talking about a 50-something Caucasian woman who lives in the Midwest.
That's an even split between independents and interdependents. It's interesting. So 50-something would be actually that would tend to be more independent than the older generations. We find that as people are getting each subsequent generation is becoming more independent. There's a great book out by the psychologist Jean Twenge showing all these data for 200 years that people are becoming more independent in the United States. Being a Midwesterner and being a woman would pull for interdependence, and being white would pull for independence. So you can see all of this are very complicated. You know, it's not just a slam dunk which way you're going to go, but it's really useful to kind of look at all these different cultures that make you who you are, and try to figure out how you are creatively combining them in your own life.
Well, you know what? We have a caller who says it's really important for us to define culture. What exactly do we mean by culture right now?
That's a great question. And when we were surveying the literature, there are over 200 definitions out there. We take a very simple definition that cultures are patterns of institutions, ideas, daily interactions, and also individual psychologies that help us figure out how to think, feel, and act.
All right. So, but what we were talking about and what you examine in the book, too, that there are different cultures in terms of our gender, our religion, our race, where we live in the U.S., all of these things.
Yeah, and let me just give an example that many of your listeners will probably relate to, and that's the clash of men and women. And I recently experienced this clash firsthand. You really feel it when you go to negotiate your salary. So I know that I should be crowing about my individual contributions and my unique strengths to my boss so that I can get a raise or a promotion. But at the same time, as a woman, I am also really worried about jeopardizing my relationship with my boss by sounding too cocky. And I also am very aware that I'm part of a team and that all of my coworkers have also contributed to my contribution, to my successes and also the ways I've served my organization. And these interdependent concerns, research shows that these interdependent concerns drive many women to ask for less and to walk away from the negotiations sooner than men would. And this is why one reason why women make only 77 cents to a man's dollar, or only 17% of the U.S. Congress, and only 3.6% of Fortune 500 CEOs.
Yeah, so that's what stops our trek up the corporate ladder.
Well, it's half of the story. I mean, the other half is that men are very independent. They're not rolling out the red carpet. They're not, you know, cranking up the welcome wagon in some ways. There's still a lot of discrimination against women, a lot of harassment of women, a lot of policies that do not favor women's advancement. So it's both sides of the coin. There's a lot of conversation going on now that women need to lean in. It's on us to crash through the glass ceiling. And I always joke that there's a fine line between leaning in and falling over.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot that men also need to do as well to make our workplaces better for both men and women.
We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along. But that was one of the eight conflicts: women getting stuck as they rocket up the corporate ladder while men are falling off the ladder altogether. The other one, this one was interesting to me too. East Asian students now dominate Western schools and workplaces, yet crash into the so-called bamboo ceiling before reaching the top. I had not heard of that before, the bamboo ceiling.
Yes, that's correct. And it's really interesting because if you look at Asian Americans are about 5% of the U.S. population, but depending on the school, at elite universities, they fill anywhere from 15 to 45% of the undergraduate seats. And so you would expect this huge pipeline, and that's been true for quite a while now, you'd expect this huge pipeline of Asian American leaders. But when you actually look at the top echelon echelons of organizations, they don't have many Asians. And we find that it's because what European heritaged Americans think of as leadership is being very talkative and being very, very positive. But in many Asian cultures, the definition of being a leader and of being smart is listening and also remaining calm. And you can see, or if you think about it, you can see that being talkative and being very positive emotionally serves an independent self. This is how you express your unique internal qualities to people. But listening and remaining calm serves an interdependent side. This is how you pay attention to other people and try to fit in with them.
A third of the eight conflicts. Many blacks, Latinos, and other people of color know that discrimination keeps them down, while many whites sincerely believe that race no longer matters.
Right. So I'm actually from Memphis, Tennessee. So this one, I think, was the first cultural clash that I really became aware of at roughly the age of five. And recently I was home, and the National Civil Rights Museum is in my hometown of Memphis. And the last time I was home, a white neighbor asked me, why do we need that Civil Rights Museum? We have a black president and a Latina Supreme Court justice. I don't see race, do you? That museum just stirs up bad feelings. And I realized that this man was using his independent side, the side that thinks that people are unique and individual and therefore not affected by history or race or culture. Yet in thousands of studies now, we see that people still treat African Americans, Latinos, and other people of color according to their race and ethnicity and not according to their individual qualities. And we see this discrimination not only in laboratory experiments, which is what an experimental cultural psychologist does, but also in schools, in workplaces, courtrooms, emergency rooms. And partly because of this discrimination, people of color tend to have very well-developed interdependent selves with race and ethnicity at the core of their self-concepts.
We are talking about cultural conflicts. We are talking with a cultural psychologist who is the co-author of the new book, Clash, Eight Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. We'll talk about some of the other conflicts when we come back, and we will take your questions and your observations. What cultural clashes have you experienced? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about cultural conflicts and how cultural conflicts define us and how they can determine whether we are successful or not in the workplace, in the classroom, in life in general. We are talking about the differences that exist between people who, for example, live in the Midwest versus the West or East Coasts, between men and women, between whites and non-whites. Between different religions. We welcome your thoughts and your questions about this at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Elena Connor. She is an experimental cultural psychologist, a science communicator, and co-author of Clash, Eight Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. And we have callers who have been waiting, so let me go to Bill in Sun Prairie. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. I was the man who asked to define culture because I think that's important. I'm 70 years old, and I've watched us evolve over the decades, and it seems like some aspects of culture have certainly improved. And others, though, I feel have really deteriorated. And what we, you know, when we're talking about race and gender, religions, these are sort of like the outward expressions of culture. But underneath it all, you know, I'm thinking there has to be some fundamentals. I like Matthew Arnold's definition of culture, the acquainting of ourselves with the best that has been known and said in the world. And I was just wondering if we could agree on some fundamental principles that would kind of, you know, get us all together and stop all the conflicts. You know, maybe Platonic ideals of truth, of justice, of beauty. You know, like if we really all focused on the principle of justice, there wouldn't be any problems with discrimination or with disparities of pay in the workplace for women. I just wondered what your guest has to say about that, and, mm-hmm. and what creates culture. You know, why aren't we getting to what's underneath it all instead of just focusing on all the clashes?
What about that as a solution, focusing on something like, you know, common values like justice or truth?
It's a lovely ideal. It's very much it's an Enlightenment ideal from Europe that we imported to the U.S. And it would be great if it worked. It would be great if cultures all agreed on what is beautiful and what is right and what is justice. It's funny, a friend of mine is a cultural linguist, and, you know, she's looked at all these different languages around the world and realizes there's so little overlap between what people are actually talking about when they use language. And I think that's true also when people talk about values. I think we can agree that people want to raise their kids to grow up and be the right person in their culture, but what cultures think of as correct, as the right way to be, varies so much. And I think underlying that, I mean, your caller asked a lot of really great questions at the core of what's interesting to me about this. You know, why do we have culture if it causes so many problems? And in the book, we talk about culture as our smart human trick. If you notice, humans can live, you know, all over the surface of the earth. We can go places where, you know, other creatures don't go or where no human went before. And this is because we have the capacity to make cultures and to learn from them. You know, if it gets cold, we can make clothes. If we run out of a particular food source, we can come up with another one and figure out how to extract nutrition from our natural environment. And this is what we do as a species. We make cultures and we learn from them. But in doing that, each culture is very locally attuned to the ecology that it originally came from and what works in one, what functionally, instrumentally works in one part of the world, it often doesn't work in another. And so, I mean, there are people want to live, people want their kids to thrive, but how you get there varies so drastically across cultures that, you know, I think it's important for us to understand our differences as well as our similarities, because what has often happened has been, you know, one culture, the more powerful culture in, you know, U.S. culture and in the past century anyway, imposing its idea of what is just and what is right and what is moral and what is ethical on people who have either a slightly different idea or a drastically different idea.
Yeah. Well, is there any way then, how do we go about trying to smooth over, how to solve these cultural clashes, or do we just accept them as a part of our lives?
Well, I think, you know, it's funny, I take a very, in public health, it's called a harm reduction approach. Mm-hmm. It's accepting that there will be conflict, that humans, we're built for conflict, but mitigating the effects of those conflicts. And in the book, we recommend, you know, just in your daily life, if you find yourself having a conflict with someone else, first, don't just assume the other person is an idiot or a jerk. When we start, you know, thinking that other people are somehow less than ourselves, fundamentally bad, that's when bad things happen. That's when violence breaks out. So instead, we recommend entertaining the possibility that you're both just stumbling over a cultural divide. And when you have that in mind, first try interdependence. When we are being interdependent, we pay more attention to other people, which can give us better insights into the problem and its possible solutions. And if interdependence doesn't work, try independence. Independence is great for thinking outside the box, breaking with tradition, fighting oppression, really doing things differently. as so switching to independence for in many cases is a good strategy. And many people think they have just one self, and they keep persevering down this same path even when it isn't working. Mm-hmm. So just knowing that you have a whole other side to bring to the table is a 100% increase in your tools for solving conflicts with other people.
Interesting. So I can understand how I could become more independent, but how do I become more interdependent?
So every situation is different, but the general rules of thumb for summoning your interdependent self are, first, listen. You know, if your mouth is moving, you're doing it wrong, is our joke. Then think about how you're similar to this other person or these other people. A lot of times we focus on differences and we try to convince the other person to think our way. And instead, you know, look at, you can usually, in any situation, you're both responding to a similar set of stimuli. And so you will be having a similar experience. And remember that being flexible and adjusting to other people, it doesn't mean you're weak, and it doesn't mean you're being passive or you're letting people get the best of you. It actually takes a lot of work to fit in with other people. And finally, carefully consider how your actions are affecting other people, rather than kind of how you can have control over other people. But really think about yourself in this larger ecosystem that you're a part of, and how best to maneuver within it rather than trying to dominate it.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Elena Connor. She is co-author of Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. And we're welcoming your questions for her. We're welcoming maybe some examples you have of cultural conflicts. Here's one. I'm interested in whether or not you perhaps moved to Wisconsin, to the Midwest, from one of the coasts. Are you a transplant to Wisconsin? Did you experience culture shock when you moved here? Or maybe you did move away from the Midwest and went somewhere else for a while and then came back to Wisconsin, maybe because you couldn't handle the culture of that different region of the U.S. That's one of the 8 cultural conflicts. It's where you live. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We welcome your input. You can also tweet us, by the way, at Joy Cardine Show. Well, let's talk a little bit about the regional differences. So here in the Midwest, what's our culture here, and how is that different than other regions of the country, Elena?
Well, once again, there's a lot of variability within a region. Cities are different from towns, are different from rural areas. But in broad strokes, we see that the Midwest and the South tend to be more interdependent, tend to encourage people to use their interdependent sides, while the coast tend to encourage independence. And I am a Southerner. I grew up in Tennessee, where people tend to use the interdependent side of themselves. And I've always found that wherever I go, I get along better with Midwesterners and Southerners. Not get along better, but I feel more of a kinship with them because there is that emphasis on politeness and thinking of other people first and putting your relationships first that you don't feel as strongly on the coast. So when I did my undergraduate at Yale, which was great for me because I was raised by a single mother in a working class neighborhood in Memphis, and here I go to Yale and thought I was going to wind up being rich and famous. And then I spent my first 3 years in silence, just shocked to the roots of my hair over the everyday incivilities and impoliteness that were visited upon me. I mean, where I grew up, you don't interrupt someone unless they're your child or you want to get in a fight. And you certainly don't say, you're wrong or you're lying. But my classmates did this to each other and to me all the time. And I was so stressed out just waiting for a fight to break out. And, of course, one never did because in the Northeast, people tend to use this independent side of themselves and they don't let the opinions and actions of others get to them. It doesn't matter as much to their sense of themselves. But in the South, where people are more interdependent, we get our sense of ourselves very much from other people, what other people think of us. And so reputation and politeness are extremely important. And if someone insults you, it's your duty to answer the insult, often aggressively, which is why the South is the most interdependent region in the U.S., also the most polite and helpful, but also the most violent. And the Midwest doesn't really have that complex. This is known as a culture of honor in anthropology. The Midwest is a softer form of interdependence, or with less emphasis on reputation and politeness and greeting insults with aggression, but still very much a focus on the community and taking care of each other. And we often think of the South as the Bible Belt, but if you look in the Midwest, there are more churches per capita in the Midwest than any other region, and more of these other institutions that hold communities together, such as Kiwanis clubs and moose clubs and social clubs. People vote more, people visit each other more, and have deeper, longer lasting relationships than any other region.
We'll talk about the religious cultural conflicts in just a moment, but we have Lynn in Dubuque, Iowa on the line first. Hi, Lynn.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, it's just so neat hearing what you're discussing this morning. And one of the things, when talking about, like, the coast that you go to, how about Alaska? I'm originally from southwestern Wisconsin. My husband is from Dubuque, Iowa here. And he was in the Air Force. We were stationed in Alaska. I was there for nearly 3 years. And just the people there, I think they're a neat amalgam of what you're speaking of today, because I know just walking around, if we weren't on base, you know, where we kind of had this, like, community, you know, sense of feeling, when we went outside of base, you know, not just Anchorage, but even down near places like the Kenai Peninsula or down to Homer, Alaska, it was like, you know, you don't bother anybody. And maybe some of it is, you know, the weapons control laws up there, you know, where you're allowed to conceal at any time, you know, but it's just like it's like everybody had a personal bubble and you respected that. And it was so strange coming back in Alaska. I don't know if you know this, but they refer to anything outside of Alaska as outside.
Uh-huh.
So people, if they were going on vacation, you know, oh, I'm going outside. I'm going to visit relatives in California. Oh, I'm going outside. I'm going to visit family in Texas. It was just, it took me a while to get used to it, you know.
Yeah. How different is it now back in this region, Lynn?
Not terribly different, but the one thing that I kind of grew to appreciate up there was that respect of, like, a personal bubble, or where I could just be left alone. You know,
yeah.
It's like if I'm with family and friends, you know, okay, that's fine. But if I just want to be left alone, I just want to be alone, then it's kind of hard back here, because I feel like I'm always, you know, people are always trying to include, and it's just like, no, it's okay. I'm okay. I prefer that solitude. And that was something that just came very easily in Alaska. And just, you know, only being there for 3 years, it's something I know my husband and I have talked about. It's like, oh, we'd like to be back there for numerous reasons. But the thing I look forward to is just like, I just feel less alone.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Lynn. I would guess that Alaska would be more independent, Elena.
Yes, certainly. In fact, it's sort of the wild, wild west. Mm-hmm. And frontiers tend to require independence and also instill independence. So this is the western coast of the U.S. plus Alaska. This is the most independent place. These are the most independent places in the U.S. And so her stories really ring true with what we find in our book. And it's interesting because, the frontier regions, even in other countries, in Japan, for instance, we think of Japan as being very collectivistic, very interdependent, but the northernmost island is called Hokkaido, and it's their wild, wild west, except for it's the wild, wild north. And my colleague Shinobu Kitayama did research showing that the college students in Hokkaido are just as, these are Japanese college students, are just as independent as you Americans, generally speaking. And when we look at research from around the country, we see that it is the Western residents of the U.S. who use their independent sides the most, even more so than than the East Coast. One of my colleagues did research comparing Boston to San Francisco, and many people think of both as latte-drinking, sushi-eating, liberal enclaves overrun with independent liberal elites.
Right.
But if you compare San Francisco to Boston, you see that San Francisco is even more so. And I can there's not a lot of research in Alaska. There's not a lot of people in Alaska. But you know, definitely the stories that your caller was sharing ring true with what we know about frontier regions being very independent places.
Well, let's take another call from Nick in Waukesha. Hello, Nick.
Hi. I'm from Wisconsin originally. I was stationed in the Army at Fort Hood, Texas. And Texas is interesting, not just because it's a southern state, but everyone will tell you that it's its own country. They are so proud of themselves. They say things like, well, you know, Texas is the only state that can fly the flag, the state flag, at the same height as the national flag, because it used to be a country, stuff like that. And they're just, they're very polite, but they're also very, very headstrong. And southern food is also pretty huge down there. They don't really care so much about if food is bad for you, because it's good. You know, they enjoy things like that. Whereas I've noticed in the northern states, we're much more health conscious.
Oh, is that true from your research, Elena?
Yes. In fact, what we find in the book, it's not my personal research, it's the research of two of my colleagues, Glenn Adams and Vicky Plout, and their team, looking at places where you have a lot of mobility, where people are coming through, where you have high population density and high income, which tends to be in the cities of the coast and also a few cities in the Midwest and the South, as opposed to suburban or rural areas, where you get a lot more suburban and rural areas in the Midwest and the South. And what they find is when you have a lot of choice in people with whom to associate, personal appearance becomes a lot more important, because people need a sorting mechanism. There's all these people, who am I going to associate with? Turns out people are kind of superficial, and they go for, in these communities, and they go for the more attractive people. Whereas when you have a place where you don't have a lot of social mobility, you know, you tend to hang out with the people you go to church with, the people you grew up with, personal appearance doesn't matter so much. So these stereotypes about the coast being more superficial and more kind of caught up in materialism and looks, there's a grain of truth to them, certainly compared to places where you don't have as much mobility, you don't have a lot of people moving through, a lot of people to choose from. In that case, it's, you know, shared history, shared experience, and length of relationship, and not personal appearance that start to matter in who your friends are.
We're talking about cultural differences, cultural clashes between Midwesterners and coastal residents, between men and women, between whites and non-whites, and many other different areas. We'll talk next about the politics of conservative Protestants that frighten Americans of other religions, while the politics of more mainstream traditions infuriate conservatives. It's one of the eight cultural conflicts that make us who we are. We are talking with the co-author of Clash, Elena Connor. She's an experimental cultural psychologist and a science communicator. And we welcome your examples of cultural clashes that you've experienced. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with the co-author of Clash, Eight Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are, Elena Connor. And we've talked about many of these eight cultural conflicts. We didn't get to the politics or the cultural differences regarding religion yet. And we did have Randall, who wanted to say that religion naturally seems to dominate our culture because religion's very nature is to change behavior. Talk some about that, Elena, and what you found when it came to cultural conflicts with religion.
Yeah, and Randall is correct. I mean, religion and all cultural forces are about getting people to behave in a particular way. And I'm very interested in religious culture growing up in the South, where I was raised Methodist, which is a mainline liberal Protestant tradition, but I was surrounded by Baptists, which is a more conservative evangelical tradition. And I recently my Facebook account hosted an interesting culture clash. I posted a video about global warming. And in response, a dear friend from my past, who calls herself a foot-washing Southern Baptist, sent me an email that said, you know, "Don't worry about global warming, Elena. God will take care of us." And her email underscores how differently conservative Protestants and liberal Protestants think about God. Conservative Protestants think of God as very interdependent, relational, responsive, present. And like conservative fathers who both hug and spank their children more than liberal fathers, the conservative God is both more present and more punitive. You know, he's not just laying down the law, he's also enforcing it. On the other hand, liberal Protestants think of God as more independent, separate, abstract, and even distant. And this is our straight down from Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation, where God, the church separated from this idea, the Catholic idea that you need all these priests and popes to mediate your relationship with God. The Protestants wanted you to have a direct relationship with a more distant God. And these two different ways of thinking about God reflect the two different ways Protestants think about themselves, with conservative Protestants using their interdependent, relational, and cooperative sides more, and liberal Protestants using their independent, separate, and unique sides more.
Interesting. Let's go to John in Madison next. Hello, John.
Hi. There's three cultural determinants that we largely accept unconsciously in the first 20 years of our lives from our parents. And those are economic class, our political identification, and our religious identification. There doesn't seem to be much choice involved in the individual in this. I just wondered over a lifetime how malleable those three elements are. The other question I had is, the cultural clash really shows up in the voting booth, and I wondered if you could make any kind of generalization regarding a hierarchy of cultural elements that seem to be most determinative about what is done in the voting booth, say religion over political identification or economic class.
Wow, we only have 10 minutes to go.
So I'll be brief. So first of all, I think, you know, once you know that culture matters, that your very being, that your sense of individuality partly results from all the different cultures with which you've interacted, you can start actually exerting some control over how much they influence you. You'll never be able to totally override. A human being without culture is not a human being. And so the idea that we can somehow overcome all of our different cultural trappings, all of our different cultural commitments, it's just a falsehood. The name for a person without culture is actually dead. This idea that we can kind of overcome everything our parents taught us, that's not true. But yes, you can certainly, there's really interesting studies showing that where you went to college is actually a more potent force in your political activity than how your parents raised you, assuming you went to college. And so our lifetimes, all of our lifetimes, we spend acclimating, accommodating, assimilating to different cultures. And so, you know, and this is where you can exert some control, you know, if you want to change yourself, affiliate with a different culture, that's going to have at least as much impact as you peering deep within your soul to try to figure out how to change your own mind. Instead of trying to change your own mind, or in addition to trying to change your own mind, change your cultures. Those are the biggest levers, in how you think, feel, and act. And as far as the hierarchies, I don't know. I think it depends on the person which cultures really have the deepest force. I mean, you can think of also cultures as being nested in each other. Family is a culture. So your family culture is probably the biggest and strongest one that you first experience, and then kind of building out from there. But all of these cultures also are, they inform each other, and so it's a big tangle. And I don't know of anyone who does a good job of saying which ones are more powerful than others.
Let's talk about another of the eight conflicts, and very related to this comment. The have-nots still struggle in the classrooms of the haves, widening the gap between the rich and the poor. What about that?
Yeah, I mean, and this is another one I experienced firsthand. As I mentioned, I personally was raised by a single mother in a working class neighborhood, and then I went away to Yale, and I was flummoxed not just because of the north-south divide, but also the social class divide, because I was surrounded by classmates who had already developed all these unique ideas and novel opinions, plus the confidence to share and defend them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I also had ideas, but I had been taught it is better to sit silently and appear stupid than to open your mouth and remove all doubt.
Yeah.
And that kind of mentality works really well in working class worlds where you're likely to, you know, wind up with a job where you're taking orders. You know, this is not the place to show how, you know, individually awesome you are. And so I did. I sat there in mystified silence, earned mediocre grades, and then worried that the admissions office had made a terrible mistake. And then years later, as a cultural psychologist, I came to understand my struggle as this clash of independence and interdependence that, an interdependent culture of working class America, and especially in the South, you do learn how to fit in and how to not draw too much attention to yourself and to, you know, try to get along. But then, you know, at Yale and this the coastal culture, northeastern culture, and upper middle class culture in particular, they expect you to show up with your brilliant ideas well formed and ready to defend them. And our lab at Stanford now has several studies showing that the clash of independence and interdependence holds back many talented working class kids who beat the odds and get into college and then falter because their interdependent selves are neither supported nor reflected in college culture.
Let's go next to David in Wisconsin Rapids. Hello, David.
Good morning. Good morning to your guests. I'm wondering how the effect of the media, and I won't even go into television, but talk radio, I don't have to name the names, but some of the things that you hear on talk radio these days wouldn't have even hardly been said in private before, or you might hear some of them from fringe politicians or fringe people, but now it seems like even mainline politicians, the way they talk to each other and about each other, it seems to give license to people to be rude. And an email, for example, people would send an email to say things in an email to someone that they would never say to their face. I've already found myself looking at an email and deciding, hey, I better not send this because I was responding to someone, and it seems like this gives license to people, not to speak of the language that's used, but just the thoughts expressed and the kind of a meanness.
So are we having more cultural conflicts because of technology, because of a rise in incivility in politics, Selena?
I feel your pain. I mean, as a Southerner, who's contending with all a level of rudeness that I was not prepared for, mm-hmm. It's always kind of shocking to me. I feel there's a few forces at work here. One, and they feed into each other. As a American culture as a whole is becoming more independent. And this really started with the baby boomers and then subsequent generations that have focused on expressing your uniqueness and your individuality and being in control and, you know, sloughing off social influence, especially from your parents or older people. And so we do have just this very strong individualistic, independent streak now that even more so than, 25 years ago. And then we have technologies that enable that. You know, you can, you don't have to necessarily interact with living, breathing human beings anymore. You can interact with them through technologies that, where you don't see their reactions when they open your blisteringly aggressive and rude email. And so we've lost a lot of the face-to-face contact that really maintains interdependence, and replaced it with technologies that support independence. And there's a lot of pros to that as well. You know, it's not all bad, but this is a consequence, is the rising daily incivility of American culture, mainstream American culture. There are obviously pockets of civility and interdependence, but as a whole, we are becoming more independent and, unfortunately, less nice to each other.
Well, we didn't get through all eight of the cultural conflicts, but we'll save some for the readers of the book. What are these cultural clashes good for us in any way? Do they teach us anything useful?
Good for us. I mean, I think they're inevitable. I think people, even when we were hunter-gatherers in the late Pleistocene, you would come across a different band of hunter-gatherers and say, "You're doing it wrong. That's not how you collect the blueberries. That is not how you trap the fish." Mm-hmm. And so I think difference is a source of conflict, but it's also a source of growth. It's kind of how you handle the differences. They are inevitable. We're not all going to agree on everything ever. There's too many of us with too many different backgrounds and too long of a history of conflict. But if we can all figure out how to negotiate our differences, get in touch with our interdependence, and smartly leverage our independence for innovation, I do think we can paint a brighter future for our species. And certainly it's time for us to change the track that we're on now.
Yeah, we have just a minute to go. Nancy emails, "I learned of a study in a recent class which kids at summer camp were divided into two groups. Mm-hmm. Each group chose a name, and from there the group identities took on the lives of their own, including an us versus them mentality. The only way the problem was resolved was through creating a situation where there was a common cause."
Mm-hmm.
Does this apply to the cultural conflicts that you've been discussing today?
Absolutely. That's a classic study in social psychology called the Robber's Cave Study. And certainly, that cooperative spirit, this is what I'm also endorsing, is first focus on interdependence, figure out what we have in common. A lot of times, unfortunately, politicians, leaders have made that common ground a common enemy. But it doesn't have to be a common enemy. It can also be a common cause. We have plenty of common causes ahead of us as we are dealing with global climate and global social issues and global environmental issues like we've never had to deal with before. And so it is the time for us to learn how to, once again, use both our independence and our interdependence to not just survive, but thrive in the 21st century.
That's great. Thank you so much. Elena Connor is co-author of Clash, 8 Cultural Conflicts That Make Us Who We Are. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.